Well, that's pretty dramatic. I want to say hi to, I feel like I ought to have something profound to say after that, man. Hi to everybody at all of our campuses, everybody right here in this room. Way to go, way to brave the elements and come to church and love people and love God. And I want to say hi to everybody that's watching online that wimped out and stayed home. May God have mercy on your souls. But we're looking at real important issues over these next couple of weeks. I'll start with this. When I was a sophomore, 15 years old, I got mononucleosis. I played tennis all through school, but I couldn't play that season because I had mono. Actually, it was called the kissing disease back then. But I grew up Baptist, so I wasn't allowed to kiss. I had to arrange to get the disease in other ways. And I couldn't play tennis most of the season. I tried to play the district tournament right towards the end. And it was a bad idea. I didn't play well, double faulted. Coach was yelling at me across the all six courts. I was kind of looking over like, you know, I'm not trying to play bad on purpose. Then afterwards, the team gathered together and he looked at me and said, "Don't ever look at me that way again." And then he smacked me in the face. And I was just unprepared for that. Back then, tennis was not a sport where you expected to get hit a lot. And I wanted to play for the next couple of years. But I don't have to tell you, my relationship with this person just kind of shifted. And I realized over time, I kind of feel like it was kind of a bullying thing to do. Like, I couldn't do anything back, and he was in charge, so I was just kind of stuck. And I say that because I think for a lot of people, we wonder, what is God like? Is God really out there in our private hearts? I don't mean the stuff that we think we're supposed to believe or we think somebody teaches, but just who is that person? And there's a lot of ideas that just kind of float in the ether. They often get expressed not so much through books, but stuff like cartoons. There's a guy, Gary Larson, that draws The Far Side. There's this picture of God on his computer, poor guy walking with a piano suspended over him and God's fingers right above the smite button. And so you wonder, is that what God's going to do? There was a movie a few years ago, Bruce Almighty, a deeply theological movie, and Jim Carrey, this character in it, doesn't get what he wants, and so he cries out to heaven, "Smite me, almighty smiter." And it just raises, is that what God does? Does he just want to smite people? And this idea gets expressed sometimes in the oddest way. Some of you will know about this. In the insurance business, there's an expression, if destructive acts are happening, like flooding, we're all thinking about this week, or earthquakes, or hurricanes, or tornadoes, they will be called, some of you will know this, acts of who? Acts of God. How do you think it makes God feel when those are the things that we call acts of God? There are other natural events, tropical breezes and sunsets, and we don't call those acts of God, just terribly destructive things. So there's just this idea kind of out there. God must be kind of a mean, kind of a destructive person. Sometimes these get articulated very thoroughly. There's a guy named Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins believes very strongly that religion is a bad thing and that the God presented, especially in the Old Testament, is a bad person. He wrote a book called The God Delusion. This sentence is by far the most famous sentence in that book. He writes, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." And he gets kind of nasty after that, so I won't quote him any farther. But it's not just atheists that wonder about that. People that are seeking about religious truth wonder. Believers will sometimes read the Bible, and there'll be these stories where God apparently commands Israel to wipe out enemies, or these real harsh directives, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth are given, or God ends somebody's life. And thoughtful people are just going to raise this question, is there a God? And if there is, what's he like? And what does the Bible really say about him? And how do I square all of that stuff? And this is real important. This is something for you all to think about. I would suggest that your actual idea of God is the most important object in your mind. Whether or not you think there is hope and meaning attached to existence, whether there's somebody that we can confidently trust or not, and again, I'm not just saying what you think you're supposed to affirm, but that that part of your mental map, that's the most important thing in your mind. And if I think that there's a God that's a bully, I'll never be able to feel close to him. I will want to avoid certain parts of the Bible because I'm afraid they will shake up my faith if I get really honest about looking at it. I will never be able to have the kind of joyful confidence in this God that could enable me to live a confident life. I'll never be able to surrender. I'll always be afraid if he's out there, he's kind of after me, so I could never really abandon him. I could never really surrender to him. I'll always think, I got to keep the option open of taking care of myself. So over the next couple of weeks, there's an awful, awful lot at stake in what we're going to be talking about at the deepest fundamental levels of how we live our lives. Is God, we're going to look at, is he legalistic? Is he judgmental? Is he this distant character that's kind of cold-hearted? But this week we look at God and anger. It's a huge topic. Now, I want to do that by going through some real important questions. The first one is, what does the Bible mean when it talks about God being angry? And if you've read the Bible much, you'll have seen these statements that talk about the anger of God. Like way back in the Old Testament, we're told, so the Lord's anger burned against Israel because they were disobedient. And he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years. That's a long time to wander. Or Job's talking about evildoers. It says, by the breath of God, they perish. And by the blast of his anger, they come to an end. Real straightforward statements about God being angry. Now, part of what's interesting is at the same time, the Bible talks quite a lot about human beings getting angry. And essentially every time it says, that's not good. People shouldn't get angry. So Ecclesiastes, anger resides in the lap of fools. Very picturesque way of saying it. Or Paul will come back to this one, says to a group of people in Ephesus, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. And do not give the devil a foothold. So one real important idea in the Bible is that anger as God, whoever God is, experiences it is very different than anger as you and I experience it. So we can't attribute our experience of anger to God. Now, when you think about humanly speaking, what happens to you when you get angry? A bunch of stuff does. Your muscles clench, they tense up. Your blood pressure rises. Your heart rate accelerates. You have these neurotransmitters that give you a surge of energy. These are all things that happen to your body. For human beings, anger is intrinsically a physical, a bodily sensation. And the more angry we get, the more our bodies get taken over by anger. And we'll talk about people just losing it or people melting down. Or in our day, there's the part of your brain that's associated with emotions called the amygdala. And there's a little phrase that when somebody really, really goes crazy, they suffer an amygdala hijack. The amygdala hijacks their whole central nervous system and they become incapable of rational thought. There's a kind of a superhero, weird character, and he experiences tremendous bodily transformation when he gets really angry. Anybody know who that superhero is? The Hulk. That's exactly right. When he's normal guy, I think it's Steve Bannon, he will say, don't make me angry. You would not like me when I'm angry. And now, in the ancient world, when people thought about the gods, they thought of them kind of like we think of superheroes, but real, that they had these superpowers, but they all had fallible human characters. So if they got mad, man, watch out. You don't want to be around them then. And if you see stories about Zeus had real anger control issues, Thor, guy that had the hammer, real anger control issues. Now, whether or not you believe what the Bible says is true, this is fundamentally important. When it talks about God and anger, we can't think about it like we do anger and people or anger and superheroes. For one thing, because it says God is perfect. He's never mean, never sins in what he thinks or what he does. But also because God is spirit, we're told in the Bible. This real important dimension of who God is, God doesn't have a body. And what that means is God never loses it. God never melts down. God's heart never races because he doesn't have a heart. His blood pressure never rises because he doesn't have blood pressure. God never melts down. He never has an amygdala hijack because God doesn't have an amygdala. In fact, God doesn't have a brain. And he's never missed having a brain at all. That's why Dallas Willard says, for God, every decision is a no-brainer. Don't groan at me. That makes me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry. But humanly speaking, anger is a very deep part of our bodily experience. And in the Old Testament, this is captured in real colorful ways. The Hebrew language and culture is very concrete, very physical. And the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for anger, literally, chap, is the word for nose. That's literally, when we read the word anger, that's the Hebrew word for nose. When you get angry at somebody, especially in ancient time, they would think about your nostrils flare up, or you raise your nose in contempt of somebody. Your face will get red because the blood collects, particularly in that area. A real important anger phrase in the Old Testament is this one, slow to anger. And literally, that means long nose. When you see that phrase in the Bible, to be slow to anger, literally in Hebrew, it's to be long nosed. If you look at the person next to you right now, if they have a long nose, they are a godlike human being. You want to be reverent towards them. If they have a short, stubby little nose, they have a short, stubby little fuse. My dad used to kid me when I was growing up for having a short, stubby little nose. Made me so mad I wanted to slap him. But in the Bible, this phrase is used to describe God. Now, when you think about how did they view God, God is called slow to anger. And this is so central to God's character that it's part of his name. Okay, when he reveals himself to Moses, early on as the human race is learning about God through Israel, this is what God says. Then the Lord came down in a cloud and stood there with Moses and proclaimed his name, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, the long-nosed God, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. That's God's essential character. That's God's name. And that little phrase, slow to anger, is used 7 times in the Old Testament to describe God. Every single time it's paired with that next phrase, he is abounding in love. That's the God of the Bible. He is not mean. He is not irritable. He does not fly off the handle. He is slow to anger. So then if we're going to be honest, that leads to the next question. If that's the case, why is it in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, God seems to get mad for such reason? It just seems like he flies off the handle. And I thought, kind of by way of helping us just roll up our sleeves and learn about this, we would look at one of the most prominent stories in the Old Testament that is a weird anger story in our day and find out how did this look to them? Because it's real important when you read the Bible, whether you believe it's inspired or not, assume that it's written by intelligent people who understand the law of contradiction and are at least as bright as we are, and that they believe that this God is slow to anger. Okay, so in this particular story, the Ark of the Covenant is being returned to Jerusalem. The Israelites have won it back from the Philistine. Big parade, big celebration, 30,000 people watching. The Ark is put in a cart being drawn by 2 oxen and guided by a guy named Uzzah. Then this weird thing happens. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out, took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. What was that? Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. Now, this kind of story, a lot of times you read this in the Bible, it's like, what in the world's going on? Seems like Uzzah did something he should be commended for. Why would God do this? But again, it's written by people who understood God to be slow to anger. So let's walk through it for a moment. In the Old Testament, there are real clear instructions on how the ark was to be transported. And all the Israelites reading the story, they would know all about that. It's repeated numerous times. The ark's this box, real important to Israel. It's got the Ten Commandments and the manna in it. So it had gold rings on it. Poles were to go through the rings. And then priests were to carry those poles so the ark would be up on their shoulders. And this is not coincidental. There's a real important reason for this. The ark, because it had God's law, the Ten Commandments in it, was kind of like the expression or the embodiment or the presence of God in Israel's midst. It was the most sacred thing in all of Israel. It's like how they treated the ark taught the people, how do we treat God? Again, in their culture, in the ancient world, if a king was going from one place to another, they would always be transported on what was called a litter. There would be a throne or a seat. There'd be rings in it, poles put through the rings, and then the noblemen, the servants of the king, would carry the king. And that in itself was a tremendous honor to be able to carry the king. That was a way to teach all the people, we will honor the king, we'll revere the king, we'll follow the king. Okay? You would never, ever, ever put the king in a cart driven by a couple of oxen. You'd never do that. It's kind of like when Nancy and I had our first child, Laura, and we found in public places, she ran all over the place, she was hard to corral. So we actually bought, it's a little embarrassing to admit, a leash. Any of you ever see a leash for a kid? And you put them in a little halter with a little choke collar? And no, there was not a choke collar, but there was a halter. And so we used it one time at the Pomona County Fair, and I'll never forget, this is 30 years ago, but so many people would just look at us and say, look, those people have their child on a leash. And so we never used the leash again because a leash is for dogs. Stroller is for children. A hand is for children. That's how you kind of honor the dignity of a child, okay? In the ancient world, it was real clear, you don't put the king in a cart. It would be an insult. To make things worse, the whole reason that Israel lost the Ark of the Covenant in the first place was because they had mistreated it. Years ago, they went to battle against the Philistines, and they thought, again, part of what you have to understand in the Old Testament, part of why there's the severity there, it's a little bit like raising a kid. It's like, yeah, God's starting from scratch, from a blank slate. They know nothing. And so they think of God, of course, as an idol. He's just this force that we don't have to obey. He's not concerned with justice or love. We can manipulate him to get what we want. So they're going into the battle. They say, well, the ark, that's kind of God's presence. It's a magic box. So we'll bring it into the battle. And if we have the ark there, we win. God's in our pocket. God's under our control. God has to teach them quite a painful lesson that he is not under their control, that he is not in their pocket, that this is not superstition, this is not idolatry, that the spiritual is not some kind of force that can be used for selfish human beings. How are they going to learn this? So they lose the ark. And this is the occasion when the ark is coming back to Israel. The whole reason why they lost it was they don't understand about God yet. And to make things worse, there's 30,000 people and they're watching. And how the ark is treated is going to be how they learn to treat God. Is God an object to be manipulated for me? Or is he a person to be loved and obeyed? See, this whole story starts to get into then, like, how am I treating God? Starts to turn the tables on me. And so this putting God in a cart is a deliberate insult. It's a demeaning thing that will lead all the people irreparably into error in thinking about and living with God. So it's got to be addressed. But then that still leaves the question, isn't death way too severe a punishment for Uzzah? Couldn't he get like a timeout or something? So a word about God and death. For us, when we look at death, it's the worst possible outcome. I was talking about that prayer from Jim Carrey, smite me, almighty smiter. Old Testament scholar David Lamb says that actually is kind of a prayer by an Old Testament character named Elijah. He's real frustrated with God. At one point, things aren't going well. And his prayer is, this is enough. I have had enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life. Smite me, O mighty smiter. God doesn't do that. God encourages him and sends him back into the fray. Eventually, God does bring Elijah's life to an end, but it's not punishment. It's quite an extraordinary story. God actually sends a chariot of fire, and Elijah goes home to God. See, from our perspective, when we see death, and if God's involved, we think of it as just this awful, terrible punishment because we don't know what's on the other side. It is, I think, very much like when our oldest daughter was a real little girl. Sometimes she would come to me and she would say something like, Daddy, when I grow up, will you promise me that you won't make me go away? Daddy, when I grow up, can I live at home with you forever? And I'd have to say to her, well, no, I know that you want that now, but the day is going to come when you're going to want to leave home. And she would say, no, Daddy, that will never happen because I would never find a man as smart and strong and wonderful and charming as you. And I would say, well, that's understandable, but, you know, Someday you will see it differently. Go talk to mommy and you'll find out. The day will come, not today, not tomorrow, but it's going to come when you'll grow up and then you'll know. And see, death is so much that way. We look at death and it's the worst. In fact, for one person to inflict death on another, thou shalt not murder, is generally the ultimate action of hostility, because it means I wish that you did not exist. Death to God does not mean I wish that you did not exist. To God, it is simply a relocation, and it can be a homecoming. Even for foolish old Uzzah, if Uzzah really wants God. You know, see, this is terribly important. As you read through the Bible, as you read through those Old Testament stories, then you must believe if God is truly by nature slow to anger and abounding in love, then he does in life and in death the absolute best that can be done by any human being. That's who our God is. And that's why Jesus loved the God of the Old Testament so much. It leads to another really interesting question. Is God a loving God or an angry God? By the way, the whole phrase loving God, you know, it's an idea that God is a loving God. That's not been a constant for the human race. Nobody thought Baal was a loving God or Molech was a loving God or Zeus was a loving God. Where did the idea that God is a God of love? We'll hear that now as if it's always been around. People say, I believe that God is a God of love. Where'd that idea come from? Well, it came from this little country of Israel and then was spread to the world through Jesus. That's where it came from. And sometimes people will say, you know, I like the God of love that Jesus described, not that God of the Old Testament. But I'll tell you who would never say that is Jesus, because where he got all his information about God is from the Old Testament, where it says the first commandment is love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Anything else is moral insanity. And guys, part of why Israel loved that commandment is because it says that God wants to be loved. What an amazing thought that God wants to be loved. And so Jesus taught about that. Now, this is a really important thing. When we think about love and anger, the opposite of love is not anger. The opposite of love is malice. Malice is the will to harm. Anger isn't that. Anger is an emotion. Anger is what I experience when my will is thwarted, when somebody does something that I don't want them to do. Particularly when I think I've been wronged. But there's a problem with human anger, almost always with human beings. When my will is thwarted and I think you did it, I want to hurt you back. And it leads to malice almost in every occasion. Maybe for some of us and everyone because of just the way that our wires have gotten crossed in our bodies. This is why James says, everyone should be slow to become angry. Why? Because human anger, notice not God's, human anger does not produce the goodness that God desires. Human anger produces this sense inside me that I'm right and you're wrong and I'm superior to you. I am morally above you. I'm a victim. That's why we enjoy anger. Part of why it's so dangerous and so hard to get rid of is we like being angry. Then I'm the victim. Then I deserve sympathy. Then I get to retaliate against you. This is why anger is so irrational. People do the craziest thing. I grew up playing tennis. Guys get mad on a court. What do? Any tennis players here? Do they get mad enough? They will take a racket, which costs a fair amount of money, and smash it to smithereens. Why would you do that? Like, it's the racket's fault. It's not my fault. This racket deserves to be punished. I want this racket to feel the pain that it has inflicted. Like, really? I will get mad at my phone. Anybody ever get mad at it? This is an amazing thing. But no kidding, I was talking to Siri not long ago, and I said, Siri, call mom. And Siri said, I don't know your mom. In fact, I don't know you. And I said, Siri, you moron, my mom is listed in my contacts as mom. And then I remembered Jesus said that you're not supposed to call another person a fool. Then I remembered Siri's not a person. So I actually said, Siri, you're a fool. And she said back to me, I'm a fool for your requests. She actually is programmed to say that. You test your Siri. We just get angry at all kinds of stuff because anger is irrational in us. God, see, is not Siri. God is not a force. God is a person. God does anger, but God doesn't do mean. God doesn't do malice. God never wills to harm. Another story about God's anger in the Bible. God tells Moses to go to Pharaoh. I want to free my people. Pharaoh is oppressing them. And Moses just keeps putting God off. Don't want to do it. Who am I? God's so patient. Doesn't matter who you are, I'll be with you. Who are you? God says, I'm the God, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Moses says, no. They won't believe that you sent me. And God says, I'll do signs. Moses says, no. I'm not good at talking. God says, I made your talker. I'll help you. Moses, no, send somebody else. And then God's anger burned against Moses. So what does God do? Does God smite him? God hurt him? No, he sends Aaron along to help him. Sends him and does amazing things to release his people. God does anger, but God doesn't do malice. God doesn't do mean. And see, it's really important to understand the connection of love and anger, because God is a person, and therefore God loves and God feels deeply, and anger is connected to love. C.S. Lewis put it like this: anger is the fluid that love bleeds when you cut it. You know, one way I can sin with anger is I get mad when I shouldn't. But another way, much more rare, but it happens quite a lot, is I can fail to get angry when I should, when something's happened that a human being ought to be angry about. Pilot told me his favorite flight story one time is a flight from New York to Florida. Elderly couple gets on the plane and they shuffle, they move slowly because they're very old. And there's a guy behind him just being a jerk. He's mocking them for holding him up. He's, you know, real self-important guy, just kind of obnoxious. He sits right in front of them. He's mean to the flight attendants, quite surly to the other people there. He's not satisfied with his meal. He sends his meal back twice on a plane. Second time, just to show his contempt, after he sends it back, he jerks his seat back as hard as he can on purpose, and it causes all the food and drink to spill on the dress of this elderly old lady sitting behind him. And everybody's just, can't believe this guy. Flight attendant comes up to the elderly couple and apologizes and asks if she can help, and the old guy says, appreciate that, actually, we're on this trip because we're celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary. We've been saving up for a long time. We've never been on a plane before. This is our first flight. And so she feels terrible. She brings him a bottle of champagne, and he stands up and uncorks it and pours it over the head of the guy sitting in front of his wife. And everybody in first class applauds, because every once in a while, something happens that somebody ought to get angry about. Now, you think about our world. How often does somebody get mistreated? How often does somebody get bullied? How often does an innocent person get ripped off? What kind of God would God be if he could look at our world every day, billions and billions of people, and every day, countless number of people unseen that can't do anything back, elderly people getting abused, little babies who have done nothing wrong getting beaten, innocent people getting gunned down, whole races being demeaned because of the color of their skin, human beings being trafficked like they were objects. What kind of God could look at that and just say, well, you know, that's the way it goes? If God is any kind of God, then he's got to get angry. And the Bible says that he does, but he doesn't do malice and he doesn't do sin. And therefore, guys, for you and me, when we get angry, we're to bring our anger to God. We're to surrender to God. We can't trust the way that we'll handle it. This is why Paul says to that church, in your anger, doesn't say never get angry. He says, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And do not give the devil a foothold, because it's not God, it's the devil, it's the evil one that gets a foothold in our anger. And so where this all comes out for you and me is surrender my anger to God. Because only God can handle anger. And I have a lot of it, and so do you, more than you realize. I've been just thinking about it a lot and noticing it in myself this week. And sometimes, and some of you may come out and exploding, a lot of us it comes out in much sneakier or more passive ways or pouting ways or Scandinavian ways. I was coming home from church this week one day, and it had been a long day, so I was just thinking, I'm entitled to just rest. When I get home, I just want to do nothing. And I get home, and Nancy, my wife, says to me, there's a couple of boxes on the floor. When you have time, would you look through them and see what should get stored and what can we throw away? Now, this was an eminently reasonable request. Those boxes are my boxes. They have been on the floor in our condo since we moved into our condo 2.5 years ago. Those boxes have been on the floor every day. My wife has seen them. After 2.5 years, she asked, when you have time, would you mind looking? So how do you think I responded to that? Do you think my immediate inward thought was, thank you so much for raising that issue? How delinquent I have been in procrastinating and leaving those boxes there. How helpful it is for the joy of our feng shui and my own character development that you would alert me to this. Thank you, wife of mine. I did not. I just, what happened inside me was, I've been working so hard all day. I shouldn't have to do this. I don't feel like doing this. She ought to know this. Instead, she has laid this burden on me. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in that room right now, even though I'm tired and she knows I want to rest. And I'll go through all the papers in both of those boxes, no matter how long it takes, no matter how miserable it makes me, no matter how much I have to suffer and allow that suffering to inflict everybody else, and then she'll know. Am I the only one that ever thinks that way? And of course, all those thoughts are, they're not as clear as I've articulated them to you. I'd see how ridiculous they are. They're just this kind of fuzzy, smoldering, stupid, living away from God. And that's what, they just build up like that one after another, after another. Unless I allow God to come in the next morning, I'm kind of going through this. And it's just, that was so stupid. So I called my wife up and told her and said, I'm just such an idiot. And she said, I know. And then, you know, we can walk through that. And then there's this amazing thing God has given when it comes to anger that God invented called forgiveness. And that's what can happen when I bring my anger to the cross. See, the cross is where God's anger at sin and God's great love for sinners meets. It's in the cross where anger and love meet. And the result is forgiveness. This amazing power that can be a part of my life and yours, that will heal the malice that anger unleashes in us. That's where I just want to mention this one last question. So many people wrestle with this. Again, at a real deep level, maybe not at the conscious level or what you think you're supposed to say, but so many people just wonder, is God mad at me? Is God sitting up in heaven, wagging his finger, shaking his head, didn't get it right? No, 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 no. And I want to tell you, it is true that God experiences anger, and that's a real good thing. But if you come to him at the cross with an open heart,